Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years, Literary Arts in Portland. This time, Robin Koss-Lewis. Robin Koss-Lewis was born in Compton, California. When she was six, she told her mother that she wanted to be a writer. At that time, she thought that could only mean being a novelist. In pursuit of that goal, she studied comparative literature as an undergraduate, attended NYU's creative writing program, and earned a master's degree in Sanskrit and comparative religious literature. Everything changed for Lewis after she had an accident that caused her permanent brain damage, keeping her bedridden for 2 years. As part of her long recovery, her neurologist limited Lewis to reading and writing one sentence a day. So she decided, quote, "Okay, if that's one line a day, it's going to be a goddamn good line." It was at this time she realized she was a poet. Her debut collection, Voyage of the Sable Venus and Other Poems, won the 2015 National Book Award for Poetry. It was the first debut book to be awarded the prize since 1974. The book is a triptych, lyric poems exploring desire and race, bookend the title piece, which is made up of titles, catalog entries, and descriptions of art depicting the black female figure. The citation from the National Book Foundation praises Voyage, quote, "In poems that consider the boundaries of beauty and terror, Lewis intimately involves us with all that has formed her. The aesthetic and psychological complexity of this work is underscored by its clarity. The voice is essential to our present moment." Now, from the 2015-2016 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Robin Koss-Lewis speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Hello, Portland. I am so honored to be here. This is my second literary arts event. I came from Woodstock, I was so overwhelmed by the amount of love you guys have for literature. I know you're known for it, I know. But it's completely different when you come and experience it. And this is yet another example. I just kept saying, what do you mean? All these people are gonna come and hear a poet? I mean, even if it were Claudia's one of my besties. And even if it were Claudia, you guys are really special, but I bet you know that. Okay, so The Race Within Erasure. The valiant practice of poetic erasure has enjoyed a great amount of popularity in recent years, but the genre isn't new, nor is it specific to poetry. In fact, erasure can be seen everywhere in every artistic medium, not just poetry, and certainly not only in the literary arts. In every way, historically, politically, aesthetically, we're constantly erasing and being erased. Entire nations, histories, even categories of identity can and do come and go in both generous and violent ways. Indeed, one could argue that the entire history of human beings is a history of erasure and being redrawn and then erased again. Tonight, via discussion of love and war and most of all writing, I'll focus on the means by which the practice of erasure saturates our literature, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes brilliantly, often simultaneously. By repositioning the literary practice of erasure within the broader context of post-colonial literatures, for example, and the literatures of independence, we will discuss how erasure offers writers a dynamic tool by which to push language, and perhaps more importantly, to be pushed by language, yes? We will discuss how erasure allows us to play more, to engage more, uncover and utilize the historical and aesthetic gestures at work, often unconsciously, often ahistorically, within our literature. But before I go into all of that, this is the part where I pretend like I can see you. I'm just curious, how many of you guys know what a literary erasure is? Can you guys just scream out, say, I do? Okay, and so do any of you guys have an erasure practice? Scream out again, anyone? Yeah, cool, okay. Okay, great, perfect. Okay, so if I start to belabor a point, say, Robin, we know, and I'll move on, but I just wanna make sure we're all on the same page, okay? So secretly, this is a lecture about a book. My book, perhaps your books, I don't know. It's a story about how books find us and how books also disappear. And because books and bodies are so intimately related, this is also a discussion about how we disappear others and how we ourselves disappear. Erasure. It's 1979. I'm 15. I'm in 10th grade, sitting in an advanced placement English course, also known as Honors English. Although our school is 35% African American, there are only two black kids in the class, Cedric Wilson and me. All the other students are Japanese, Korean, Samoan, Hawaiian, Filipino. There are three white kids and only one Chicana. Our teacher is an older white woman named Mrs. Keller, though Cedric and I have renamed her Killer Keller. She drives an old vintage pastel blue Mercedes, the kind with the matching hubcaps at the back. We're dating ourselves, those of us who are laughing. Matching hubcaps as if the back hubcaps were its pocketbook and the front hubcaps were its gloves. On this particular day, our assignment was to stand before the classroom and recite a poem from memory. I don't remember which poem Cedric recited, but I remember his striped t-shirt, greens and beiges, yellows and browns, and every now and then a slight line of sky blue. I remember his brown denim pants, his full knock knees, his navy blue keds. I remember his short, thick fro, his stunningly small hands, and those silky, thick eyelashes that curled back onto his lids. His skin was the purest of cocoa browns, and he had pearly, pretty teeth. After Cedric recited his poem perfectly, he walked back to his desk, and just as he was slipping into his chair, Killer Keller said, "Very good, boy. Now tell me, do you like watermelon?" Then she giggled sarcastically to herself, shaking her head in disbelief, as if to say, "Lord have mercy, now they've taught the monkeys to read." No one in the class said a word. When it was my turn, I went up to the front of the room. Killer Keller had on a celadon cardigan, pearls, a floral silk scarf, and her crow black hair was wrapped into a French knot, wrapped so tightly in the back that it pulled the skin of her cheeks back and up toward her forehead. I remember the light and the smell of that place, Gardena High, Gardena, California, Los Angeles, 8 miles from the Pacific, 2 or 3 miles from where I was born, Compton, and I remember Cedric's eyes like a cow's, staring out of the window, big and wide and full of 100 languages. I can't remember the poem I chose to recite. I know it was by a woman, and for some reason I think it was Plath, but I think that's just my maudlin tendency for toward melodrama, because that would be almost too convenient. But what I can remember is this. Like Cedric, I recited my poem perfectly as well. And then as I began to walk back to my desk, Killer Keller, still sitting behind the rostrum that was her massive teacher's desk, began chuckling and clearing her throat. As I eased down awkwardly with my left-handed self into her right-hander's desk, she said in the most pleasant voice imaginable, "But can you tap dance, girl? Do you like grits?" 1979. Because I had been skipped, I was 14 in 10th grade, advanced placement English, Los Angeles Unified School District, 3 years after the passing of Proposition 13. I had read every book placed before me, but in all those 12 years of my so-called education, I had never heard the name of one black woman novelist. I never read a novel or short story by any black woman. I didn't even know there was such a creature as a black woman who could write fiction. We knew incorrectly that there had been a few poets. In fact, there had been hundreds. But we learned this correction from the adamant literary commitment of our great migration working class families, not from our schools, teachers, textbooks, nor our school districts. Which is to say, at the time that I went to high school, which is not so long ago, mind you, it was possible to earn a high school diploma in the United States without any knowledge whatsoever of the literary traditions of Americans of color. Erasure. This is urgently important not only because of its heinous history, the marriage between curriculum, canon, and race, that sloppily handled ménage à trois of hate, ignorance, and objectification played out in literature, but it matters as well because as readers, it is our responsibility to pay attention to everything in a book, not only the way the writer wants us to read her project, but we should also attend scrupulously to the parts of the book of which the writer is wholly unaware. We should read not only the way a teacher or academic school wants us to digest literature, but we should dig further, deeper, step inside whatever little door our particular minds can see. Like a photograph, a poem or story erases what is outside of its frame. But here's the curious part, also like a photograph, it captures the unintended. And sometimes that turns out to be the most engaging part of a text, its accidents. Literary erasure is both an aesthetic and political tool that can allow and buoy this restraining to see what else lingers in a text. As you go on to read and write over the years and decades, I don't know about you guys, but my eyes are starting to go dull. I don't mean literally, I mean aesthetically, yes? Our sense of perception grows satiated and tragically sometimes even bored, disillusioned. We've all read so many stories, so many tropes, so many characters, so many plots. Literary erasures can remedy those feelings. Erasure keeps the writer's and reader's eyes fresh to language. And so today I hope to expand the very definition of erasure so that we can engage a more nuanced literary history about our world and the work we make in it. But first, a little background. What is an erasure to those of you who did not hoot and holler? It's curious, but most literary historians speak about erasure's genesis solely within the context of poetry. Boo. They talk about erasure poetics often citing Heidegger's letter to his pal Ernst Jünger. I know. Heady stuff. The story goes that in this famous letter to Jünger, Heidegger wrote the word being, but then he also crossed it out, leaving the word identifiable and dismissed simultaneously as a way to both represent and deny the existential quandary of our existence. This is my clever way of trying to show you what Heidegger did that made everybody go, whoa. Really, I mean, the continental philosophers lost their mind for like decades. That's it. Philosophers like Derrida and a host of others also wrote about erasure. They called it sous-erasure or under-erasure. Erasure then was not only a literary investigation, but also an existential one. Simultaneously, we both exist and we do not exist. We are living and dying at the same time. Furthermore, the marks we make on the page, this page, any page, like the marks we make on the world, are further evidence of our temporality, our mortality, logos, evidence, oh my God, we're going to die. Now, just as a side note here, and as a way to give you an example, I want to perform erasure on what I just did. I want to draw your attention to two things in that preceding paragraph. Yes, we're going meta, I know. Indeed, I want to erase my paragraph about the history of erasure. First of all, that sous in sous-erasure, right, by Derrida, well, that sous is actually Sanskritic. Though all Indo-European languages are Sanskrit's colloquy children, we rarely acknowledge our true mother tongue. Sous in Sanskrit is in the locative case, and when placed before a root word like erasure, for example, it means underneath, which is to say whole languages and histories have been erased from our own mouths without us ever knowing it. And secondly, it's always sexy, right, to evoke Heidegger or gesture in some way toward continental philosophy. But the truth of the matter is that erasure as a practice is as old as we are. It totally predates all of this 19th century stuff, right? Just think about the temples of Rome, for example, being built and rebuilt on earlier so-called pagan sites, statues with their heads decapitated and replaced with the current emperor, or better, his poor old wife. We could go on and on forever, all the way back to the caves. Trust me, erasure, like violence, is what we do. So please, if you learn anything from this lecture today, learn this, evoking blokes like Heidegger and throwing in a little continental philosophy and Derrida to boot is a very easy way to pretend that one is more clever than one actually is. But there is so much more to our literary traditions than that performative gesture of cleverness. And erasure can help you get to that place. It can help you to get sous-erasure. One of the best essays on erasure, then, is not Heidegger or Derrida or any of those guys. It's actually this fantastically talented young poet named Ginny Vanasco. Anybody know Vanasco's work? Ginny wrote this essay called Absent Things as If They Are Present, situating a fine history of the poetic erasure in Europe and the United States. But more than that, it was a philosophical investigation into the writer, which no one saw coming. At the time she wrote it, she was like maybe, I don't know, 25. I love that when really smart people are like in the bodies of children. It's great. They're like, you're like, I don't know what you're talking about, child. Anyway, her essay was a meditation on the individual, the author, an exploration into our drive to make a mark, to mark the world with our being. And it was also equally mysterious in our need to erase ourselves and each other, to disappear, the desire to disappear others. Jenny Venasco has a clean definition of literary erasure. You guys are still going, but what is it? Okay. She says, quote, to erase is to create a new work out of an existing one. Canonical, obscure, wonderful, terrible, it's the erasurist's choice. Hence, in poetic erasure, a writer chooses a previously published text and then literally physically erases that text in whatever manner he or she chooses. Paint, whiteout, scalpel, Photoshop, cow dung. In order to create a new text from the remaining words, a text so new, and here's the fantastically mysterious part of erasure, not even the first original writer could have anticipated its creation. Erasure is a collaboration with time and intent. Erasure often erases intent. Ironically, sometimes by removing texts from its source, erasure can even magnify the original writer's intent. When it is really, really, really good, erasure can reveal more about the projects of both writers simultaneously. Now, there are a few erasures that are so well known, they're on the verge of becoming canonical. That's an ironic statement, considering that erasure is often about investigating and interrogating, sometimes even destroying the whole nation of tradition, notion of tradition and the canon. That's another talk for another day. How, if we're vigilant and require curriculums to open and expand, what begins as a marginal critique of the center one day after generations might become a part of the central conversation. That's a terrifying thought in terms of commodification, but it's also an exalting thought as well. In her essay, New Ideas About Black Experimental Poetry, which I encourage you all to read, Elizabeth Alexander, wrote about this dynamic. She says, we name the experimental as we name any quality moment, school, or movement in literature, in large part from the vantage point of today. So what appears to be doctrinaire, even hegemonic, from here and now might well have had to fight to make it space and time. Yes, in other words, for those of us who are older, you know, it all comes around again, bell bottoms are now back in style. I evoke Alexander's observation because I want to encourage you to keep your eyes open, to notice and resist the increasing conservatism in the humanities. You guys probably aren't even aware of what's happening because there are 2,700 people in the auditorium for poetry. But in the rest of the world, you guys are beautiful. In the rest of the world, the humanities are really under attack again. More alarmingly, people are trying to do away with humanities altogether on so many different academic institutions. This is the sinister side of literary erasure. We're just going to erase literature completely. So the central theme of my argument today is that erasurists are a part of this critique. They are always looking for what and who has been left out, what remains unsaid. How tradition sometimes, even unintentionally, falsify its own literary history. The work I'm about to show you are well known, but there are numerous and varied projects being produced, and my hope is that this lecture inspires you to explore further the great practice of and history of erasure. So let's begin. This is Tom Phillips' now iconic cover of Ahimelech, a treated Victorian novel. Anybody know this one? Yeah, yay, Portland. As a source text, Phillips, a British artist, used an 1892 Victorian, what he called obscurity, a book he found titled A Human Document by a man named W.H. Malick. As erasurists often do, he erased certain letters in the original title, A Human Document, and transformed it into a new title, Ahimelech. First published by Tetrick Press in 1973, Phillips has been working continuously. I love Phillips. Okay, continuously on Ahimelech since 1966. This man has an incredible practice. When he set out to find a used book that did not cost more than 3 pence and to alter every page, quote, by painting, collage, and cut-up techniques to create an entirely new version. Now there are multiple editions of Ahimelech. There's even an app for that. So this is Radios by Ronald Johnson, published in 1977. Radios is an erasure of Milton's canonical Paradise Lost. Johnson crafted the book by taking the text from the first 4 books of Paradise Lost and erased lines, words, and letters to reveal skeletal poems underneath, quote, that took on a new meaning of their own. Mong, one of Ryrios's critics, rightly characterizes this form of erasure as representing the after image of reading. I love that. And the retention, spotty, subjective, slippery, that we carry from the last page. Johnson described his project this way: to etch is to cut away, and each page, as in Blake's concept of the book, is a single picture. It's a wonderful way to think about a book, yes? Each page is a single picture. Okay, this is Mary Ruffel's A Little White Shadow. Ruffel is, of course, an essayist and a poet. For those of you interested in craft, her latest collection of essays, Madness, Rack, and Honey, mwah! Beautiful work about that meditates on what does it mean to be a writer. This project, White Shadow, is Ruffel's ninth book. It is only one of her many erasure projects. Mary Ruffel does erasures every single day. She has a website if you guys want to check her out. She's always doing erasures. She thinks of it as a way to strengthen her aesthetic. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the source text for this is a 19th century book that she then painted over to reveal a collection of poetry. I mean, the question always, I do erasures as well, the question is always for me and other people I know who do erasures, is like, could I have written that? Right? Erasures teach you as a writer to let your mind go a little bit wild, to let your English regress to its original wildness, right? And and this is one of those like Cliff Notes shortcut ways to do that. Okay, here's one of my favorite, personal favorites. This is the Racial Holy War Bible. Anybody seen it? Oh, great, fantastic. So Rehowa stands for Racial Holy War. So it's a white supremacist Bible. And this is one of the authors, Ben Klassen. We believe that Rehowa, Racial Holy War, under the victorious flag of the one and only true and revolutionary white racial religion, creativity, what is he talking about anyway, is the only road to the resurrection and redemption of the white race. As an English teacher, I'm like, before we even get into the bigotry, that doesn't make any sense. Okay. A powerful religious creed and program for the survival, expansion, and advancement of the white race, et cetera, you get the picture. Okay. This is artist Ariana Broussard-Riffel's erasure of the Racial Holy War Bible, and she called this Between the Lines. She isn't a writer, but mostly creates installation art. For this project, Broussard took the white supremacist Bible written by the Klan and surgically removed all of the bigoted rhetoric from the book, which is to say, all of the book, exhibiting it in the pile off to the side in an installation that she titled Between the Lines. Isn't that fantastic? I love her. I just love it. In an artist statement about Between the Lines, Broussard said, "It is a white supremacist text that I cut every word out of." Essentially, I love it. It's like it sounds so serious, but it's like so fantastically funny and like political, like anyway. Essentially imposing the doctrine of racial holy war or color-based segregation onto the book itself. That is to say, she says, "I removed all the black from the white." Rendering it meaningless as a consequence. It's so good. That's what's so great about erasure. Yay, you guys get it. This is what's so great about erasure. You know how many centuries people have been writing about like what's wrong with white supremacy and what it doesn't get? Look at her with a scalpel. One book, cheap. This is a cheap. The Roha Bible is like $2.99. And a scalpel. And look at what she did, right? Okay. Perhaps this is what I most enjoy about erasure, its use of silence as an exacting aesthetic, a strident critic. You burned our books? Well, we'll cut yours up. We'll put nails in them. You should see those books. They're great. We'll strip away the excess and show us all for what we truly are, ugly, silly, glorious, contradicting, tragic, ridiculous, elated, but mostly just lost. The great British cultural critic Stuart Hall once said famously, "If you enter the debate, you validate the debate." Erasure's playful yet serious contribution is that it often gestures away from textual engagement. Talk about it, why? And instead leaps triumphantly straight towards removal. It isn't a coincidence, for example, that many British art historians refer to erasure, and not disapprovingly, as book destruction. This is poet Jim Burvin's Nets. The title is taken from Shakespeare's Sonnets, which she erased to create her own evocative poems. I like Jin's project because she represents Shakespeare's work in gray. I am of one date in time's furrows. This is absolutely one of my favorite ones, right? So for those of you up in the top, what it is, so it's a song, it's one of Shakespeare's sonnets, and you know, William Shakespeare. So there's a whole play with like William Shakespeare's name, as in will, but there's also a play with the notion of free will. So it simply says will. This is another one of my favorites, the Miz of my ken, the manuscript of my ken, the Miz of my ken. Oh, such a beautiful book. So this is Janet Holmes. And the book that she is erasing is The Poems of Emily Dickinson. I don't know if you guys can see that in beige on the book design. Yeah? Right? In this book, Holmes erases Dickinson, who some argue already masterfully erased her own writing. For those of you, your writers in the room who don't practice erasure, erasing your own writing is a really great way to get to what's really at the core of whatever gesture you're working on. But here's the remarkable gift of The Miz of My Ken. Holmes uses Dickinson's Civil War period poems, right? Something that we never, ever, ever talk about Emily Dickinson, that she wrote about the Civil War, right? Holmes uses those poems to meditate on the war waging in her, Holmes' own life at the time, and that was the war in Iraq. Here's the brilliant one. So you guys remember the war in Iraq? People don't talk about it enough anymore. The weapons of mass destruction, here we go. Men of faith slip and see evidence. Yeah. Their reward for this, empire. Yeah. Of Holmes's project, Douglas Luman observed the ways erasure can also create a new presence, oddly from the source work, that is, the original author and text that had heretofore not been seen. I know this is a really crazy thing to think about Emily Dickinson as not being seen. But in this case, right, Emily Dickinson as abolitionist, Emily Dickinson as an opponent of injustice, Emily Dickinson as being kingly, not being the freak recluse that we try to make her, but as an intellectual, very engaged poet who was keenly aware and sensitive to what was occurring in her world outside of her home in Amherst, emerges because of the erasure of her actual sonnets, right? That's what's magical about Janet Holmes' project, but others as well. Okay, this one, Voyager. Anybody know this one? Yeah, Srikant, ready? So Voyager is one of the most ambitious and successful of contemporary erasures I've ever read. In this book, Reddy performs a triple erasure. That is, he erases the book three times. The book Reddy uses as a source text is a celebrated and propagandistic memoir by Kurt Waldheim, Secretary General of the UN, from 1972 to 81. You may recall that Secretary General Waldheim was heralded as a spokesman for humanity until years later when it was discovered, after a decade in office, is that he was a former intelligence officer for Hitler, serving in the SS. And perhaps most ironically, Waldheim's memoir is aboard the Voyager right now as we speak, looking for alien life form. That's what I like about erasure. It's like so sick, it's hysterical. So his memoir was included as a gesture of token. They didn't know that he was SS. They didn't know he was SS before they put his memoir in the Voyager. Okay. on an embassy of goodwill to the aliens. So, should Voyager encounter any of aliens on its Voyager before it makes its way back to Earth one day, providing there is an Earth to come back to, what they will find is a memoir written by a former Nazi. Now I realize that in the theaters of neutrality, the heart freezes. This is a difficult problem. Everybody watches the wheel as it turns. I embraced a new work. It was engendered in my dream. It was built of desire. Experience taught me that in the final analysis, nothing ends. The first steps must follow. So that's an erasure from the Nazi wall time into Sri Kantareddy, and he does this three times. And the erasure is so well done, it's so powerful, that you cannot tell that it was once Waldheim's memoir. Here's another. Is. There is no distinction between ideology and image. One, he records his name on a gold medallion. Two, the philosopher must say is. The world is legion. The self is a suffering form. Is. Waves rise and fall, but the sea remains. Okay, so here's the Pied de Resistance by Jonathan Safran Foer, Tree of Codes. Anybody know this one? Yeah. Oh, I'm so happy so many of you don't know it because this work is so amazing. So this book is a stunning example of the die-cut technique. Tree of Codes is an iteration of a short story collection titled The Street of Crocodiles. Anybody know that work? Yeah. Great. The Street of Crocodiles, written by Polish author Bruno Schurz, first published in 1934, but not translated into English until 63. Schulz's stories detail a merchant family in a small town and feature many mythical elements. Schulz, who was a Jew, was shot and killed by the Gestapo in the streets of his hometown. Please forgive my Polish, which was occupied Drohobycz, am I right? Drohobycz, in 1942. Schulz was just 60 years old. Except for two short story collections, the bulk of his work has never been recovered. It's been disappeared. It was erased. Like the biographical information we have on Schulz, and like Schulz's oeuvre itself, Safran Foer's erasure of Schulz's Street of Crocodiles is literally full of holes. The reader is immediately aware, without any commentary whatsoever, that something invaluable is missing. A life, lives, countless lives. And yet this absence has a narrative presence, a presence of disappearances, murder, death, erasure. With erasure, absence becomes the narrative gesture, the existential telling of nothing. Silence is the monologue. I hope it's clear after viewing these erasures why I believe it paramount to reconsider erasure within the broader context of protest literature, post-colonial literature, historical and archaeological projects of recovery, engagements with the archive, critiques of canon, and homages to the disappeared. It's too easy, too dismissive, too ahistorical to merely think of these projects as art and craft hours for writers, as is often done. For example, even when considering the context of Tree of Codes, the Holocaust, the lost work of a writer whose life was extinguished by the Nazis, one critic at Vanity Fair called the book delightfully tactile and very, very cool. This kind of pastel embrace disembodies erasure's connection to other literary movements, other literary practices. I want to expand the genre of erasure. Indeed, I want erasure to erase itself. I want our idea of erasure not to be so limited in its scope, so ahistorical, so segregated in every way, including genre. Consider, for example, Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Was Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart not an erasure of Conrad's darkness? And are novels by writers like Chimamanda Adichie or Chris Sabani not also erasures of the world Achebe created after things fell apart? A century later, one writer turned Gone with the Wind to The Wind and Gone. There is a long, long list of what I'll call novelistic erasures. Consider Saramago's novels. Consider, for example, his novel Blindness. By refusing to give name to the country in which the narrative takes place, indeed by erasing all geological and geographical specificity entirely, Saramago suggests that such brutal and political atrocities can and do occur anywhere, in all places, at all times. To quote Jenny Vanasco again, absent things as if they are present. Consider Rohinton Mysteries' taut and masterful novel, A Fine Balance. Is it not an erasure of Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children? And is Midnight's Children not an erasure of the West's Orientalists insisted on heralding Indira Gandhi, who was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, as a feminist role model? Is that not a correction? Consider Toni Morrison's Beloved, so powerful in its retelling. A friend of mine who's a former Black Panther said that she felt at the end there should have been a phone number that she could call and check in. The publication of Beloved was a literary event of the highest magnitude. Indeed, it helped to change the whole study of slavery, one single book. And who could ever forget Percival Everett's novel, so aptly titled Erasure? His genius semiotic sleight of hand, wherein he performs multiple erasures at once. Characters American literature had never seen before strode casually onto the page as if they had been there all along, because they had been there all along, thereby erasing all genre expectations of the African American novel, as my father would say, toot sweet. Everett's novel is a meditation on the erasure of complexity. What remains, the meta coup d'etat of this novel, is that it performs an erasure of the American publishing industry itself. It strips publishing institutions and art institutions bare and reveals the capitalist, sexual, and racial politics so active and entrenched within the publishing industry. One book, if you haven't read it, please, please read it. Other novels, of course, take on themes with seemingly less historical pageantry while performing an erasure aesthetic as well. I just love the good old novel or film that erases the notion of white American happiness and instead exposes the myth of middle-class suburbia. These are as effective as historical or so-called philosophical novels because the context the author erases is that which is presented as the most sociologically firm. Hence, these characters are unexpected, too. The ideal of the nuclear family is regularly torn apart. There are many very successful experiments in this. Here I'm thinking of Matthew Sharp's excellent novel, The Sleeping Father, or work by Laurie Moore, yay, Antonia Nelson, yay, Deborah Landau, yay. No coincidence, I don't think, that within a society so hypnotized by patriarchy and heteronormativity, women writers would make some of the strongest contributions to this unmasking. Cinema too engages in this project. I can go on forever, obviously. The incredibly sick and hilarious film Happiness, you guys remember that movie? Or the TV serial Weeds, the list is unrelenting. And we haven't even discussed the great feat of lipograms like Jeffrey Deschelles' novel S&M, love title, which contains no punctuation to speak of. Jeffrey is fantastic, crazy. At first the gesture is jolting, but at some point, right, you start reading the book and you're like, ooh, right? At first you don't know what's happening and you can't find the floor. But listen, at some point the mind accepts the new rules, right? We can get used to anything. And that punctuation isn't always necessary suddenly. And because the book is a meditation on how messy we become during romantic breakups, how the self loses its boundaries, Deschelles' decision to lose English's diacritical marks is an inspired decision. It's just a mess. You know what I'm talking about. Once I observed a lively discussion amongst writers, novelists, about dialogue tags. This led to a discussion about rules. Someone said they were once told never to use the word suddenly. Never to use the word then. Just as an offsite, I remember Grace Paley told me once the only difference between fiction and poems is the word then. Fiction, then. Poems, no then. Okay. never use the word said, then someone else refute it, but sometimes things just happen suddenly. What the heck are you gonna say? I write all my drafts with lots of them, and then I go back and erase virtually all of them. Another offered how delicious it is to break those rules. Never use any dialogue tags, said another. Someone else said, I think all the rules, while quite useful, are more, to quote Captain Jack Sparrow, guidelines. Another quoted Josh Goldfaden as saying characters should have such distinctive voices that you wouldn't need dialogue tags for a reader to know who was speaking because the language itself would be so utterly individual. By the way, Toni Morrison, been there, done that, Tar Baby, one of the first to do it in American literature. Finally, another offered poignantly, if Laurie Moore can use the phrase, quote, the hairy kiwi of his balls, then it's game on. We writers must stick together. And in order to do so, we must embrace literary performances outside of our field of vision. Whether we know it or not, erasures are every writer's best friend, and equally important, erasure is a part of an ongoing and longer history, right? Primarily post-colonial, that battles against empire with the word. These are the gifts erasure can offer the writer, the courage to cut and keep on cutting, to push, not just the story, but the very structure of language itself. To push it, to push ourselves, to retrain our minds to think more creatively within language. It helps us to become less dependent upon linearity and logic and more engaged with myth and our imaginations. Erasure is a mirror, a means by which a writer can watch the mind resist its own imagination. Some writers, poet and fiction writers alike, practice erasures every morning, as I say. They pick up the newspaper or a page or a book, and then they erase it. It builds a set of courage. My erasure practice, for some reason, go figure, I do National Geographics. I don't know why. I like the yellow. If you're stuck in something, a flashback, a sonnet, some slow-going beginning, a sluggish subject-verb-object chapter that goes nowhere, or rhyme quatrains that are overripe and hang too heavily on a bough, put it down, go do something else, come back the next day or year, and then try erasing it. Use erasure to find the problem. I want to pause for a minute. I'm going off script. I know you guys were coming to see my boo, Claudia Rankine. Claudia told me something that I find so magnificent. She was on a panel once, and she said, it was a panel about, well, I don't forget, one of those panel titles like, you know, form and experimentation or something. And someone asked Claudia a question, does she ever write sonnets? And everybody expected you, Claudia Rankine, to say, never. And she said, of course I do. I do it all the time. I like to drop my work into a sonnet, and the way she said it was like she was filing her nails. You know how hard a sonnet is to write well. She said, I like to drop my work into a sonnet to get it to clean out all the mess, and then I pull it out and put it back into prose. So you're actually often reading sonnets, and you don't know it, right? That is also true for the newspapers. Often newspapers are written in iambic pentameter, and unless you're a freak nerd poet, you don't know it. So erasure teaches us to push back against the notion of the book, to question the mode of transmission and production entirely. Erasure sparks a jolt of immediacy. Suddenly you're standing at the bottom of an empty lake. Erasure doesn't discuss sensations like loss or intimacy or joy or terror. Erasure is loss, intimacy, joy, terror. The most magical part of all this is erasure accomplishes this by the actual omission of language, by silence, by restraint, by quieting the logic of form while enhancing the unpredictable. Even with all these examples, year after year, so many literary historians for centuries have insisted on dumbing erasure down, like the Vanity Fair comment I mentioned about a man being killed by the Gestapo. Cool, very cool. Yeah, even though most agree that the practice is centuries, if not millennia old, they insist on locating the beginning of American erasure, at least, within the context of postmodernism. And more specifically, they herald the shift that took place in American and European literature during the 60s as a result of the language poets and the surrealists. It's not that I'm trying to diss these historians. That is so not true. I actually am trying to diss these historians. But even sillier than thinking erasure an art and craft exercise is the avant-garde desire to locate erasure's beginning within the 1960s, or to suggest that language poets were the originators of the postmodern. Read post-colonial. When you hear postmodern, read post-colonial. Okay. Shift in Western literature. It's not only a historically silly idea, but it misses much of the exquisite point about the vastness of erasure's reach. and even more importantly, the vastness of literatures by people of color. Like Picasso's glorious appropriation, I'm trying to be sarcastic, like Picasso's glorious appropriation of African forms, glorious but appropriation, but glorious but appropriation, but glorious but appropriation. All over the world, from so many camps, writers of every genre who had been haunted and hunted, pursued mercilessly by a very fixed, tight, finite ideal of English. This is the part I really want to connect to the practice. These writers from countries all over the world who were colonized by English finally one day slowly turned around and began to pursue English. English became the prey, not just since the 60s, but for centuries. What I so very much want you to take away from this evening is that Erasure is as much about the politics of English and its colonial history as it is about form and object. Joyce, of course, wasn't just writing a novel. He was also attacking the limits of English. Gertrude Stein, even in her refined and very dapper bigotry, was another great murderer of the colonial indoctrination of English. Gwendolyn Brooks, one of my favorite writers of all time, performed meticulous open-heart surgery on English. Flannery O'Connor, William Carlos Williams, Derek Walcott, Salman Rushdie killed it, jumped and stomped all over it, then backhanded English about some more just for good measure, erasing form, making English bow. I could stand here all day and recite a formal list of writers and every genre who erased English, erased its name for dominance over the reader. Erasures. Erasures is a part of this history. To separate them is a great misstep. Now here I'm going to be an advocate for the devil, lest you think what I'm talking about is anarchy. I am not. I am as bourgeois as they come. I'm talking about silence, however, as a tool and not a place of powerlessness. I'm talking about silence as agency. Yes? Silence even as a weapon against the old genteel practice of thinking about literature as a bonbon. I'm aware that I am belaboring a point, but it's because I can't bear to watch a practice as ingenious and effective as erasure continue to be erased from discussions on history, race, war, colonialism, independence movements. Simultaneity, that's my Ars Poetica, erasure touches all of these. Lucille Clifton once wrote, quote, "So many languages have fallen off the edge of the world," unquote. The history of English is inextricably tied to the history of war, to the history of empire. They cannot be separated. And hence, our literature cannot be separated from these histories. Language is one of the most powerful weapons of war. It is also one of the war's first victims, from Ireland to South Africa, from Poland to the Seychelles, from Algiers to the Wampanoag, and in MFA programs everywhere. People have been interrogating and reclaiming English and other majority languages for centuries. Interrogating forms, erasing forms, creating new forms, trying anything to throw off and reinvent English simultaneously. Matthew Rohr, who did The Gentle Reader, The Erasure of the Romantics, made this stunning observation in conversation with me once. He said, "Erasure has a possibility to offer a moral corrective to the history of Western literature." I would add to that observation that erasure also allows us to add an aesthetic corrective and a formal corrective, even if that corrective is to abolish form. For to speak of erasure without the history of English would be to miss the true legacy and power of the whole practice. Western writers hold in our hands every day English, the very tool we use to create our art. Erasure makes us acutely aware of English's complexity. And then I'm going to close with a poem called Dog Talk. Okay, how do I explain this? So I grew up in LA. I'm a part of the Great Migration from Louisiana out west. And there may be some people out here that's also part of that Great Migration, Bonsoir Cuisine. And what was incredible about that is that we went back every summer, and every summer, children came back with childhood languages, and one language they came back was called Dog Talk, and it stuck, right? So I'm going to read that poem. It was a wonderful way that the children completely challenged the authority of adult culture. So I'm going to read that poem, but don't worry, you won't understand it, but then I'm going to translate it for you. Okay, Dog Talk. We be but broke of every be syllable bubble. A bower man bows but broke the bim a ban a bope of them bim for bore a bear bore a water bore a bore sabid or bore fabood. A banser burrs kabeshta bins nabame sabikrabits. We be but bent a binglabish. A bib embraced a bit the ben above rebased a bit. A bat the bus a bame to buy. This is what I call dog talk for dummies. It's not in the book. We broke every syllable. Our mouths broke them and opened them for air or water or seed or food. Answers, questions, names, secrets. We bent English, embraced it, then erased it at the same time. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you.
That was Robin Koss-Lewis speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2016. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.